Hello, friend. I need to tell you about a book that had me completely locked in. It's called Run on Red by Noel W. Eiley. Picture this, a dark, empty highway through the Idaho hills. No cell signal for miles. Two women realize the headlights behind them aren't going away. What starts as road rage turns into something far worse, a brutal, heart-pounding fight for survival that doesn't let up for a single page. Laura and Olivia can't outrun what's coming, so they have to fight back. And this book does what the best thrillers do. It takes an ordinary situation and makes you realize how fast it can go sideways. I burned through it. Every chapter drops you off a cliff. If you're into Freda McFadden or Karen Slaughter, this is your next read. Run on Red is now available as a deluxe special edition with gorgeous stenciled edges, as beautiful on the shelf as it is terrifying in your hands. Out February 24th. Grab it while you can. The Talbot Arms stood dark against the November sky. Gaslight flickered behind drawn curtains. Fog crept through Rugeley's street, muffling the last sounds of a market town settling into sleep. Across the narrow street, another window glowed. William Palmer stood at his parlor window, watching. He could see the lamplight in room 10. He could count the shadows moving behind the curtain. John Parsons Cook lay in that room, convinced the man watching him had poisoned his brandy at Shrewsbury. Yet here he was, back in Rugeley, 20 yards from the doctor he had accused. Last episode we met William Palmer, the gambling surgeon whose debts had driven him to murder. His wife, his brother, perhaps a dozen others whose deaths brought him money or relief. And we met John Parsons Cook, the racing gentleman whose victory at Shrewsbury left nearly £3,000 in his pocket, Palmer desperately needed. Cook suspected Palmer was poisoning him. He told friends at the raceway, plainly, "That damn Palmer has been dosing me." Yet he returned to Rugeley anyway. He booked his usual room at the Talbot Arms, directly across the street from the man he feared. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play.
Palmer stood at his parlor window at dawn on November the 16th, his coffee cooled beside him on the side table. He watched the chambermaid carry a breakfast tray across the street to the Talbot Arms. He counted the minutes until she emerged. The Talbot Arms was a coaching inn on Market Street, the main thoroughfare through Rugeley. Room 10 faced the street directly. Its window looked across at William Palmer's house, across at William Palmer's parlour. When Palmer stood at his window, he could see Cook's room. When Cook looked out of his window, if he had enough strength to rise from the bed, he could see Palmer watching him. 20 yards of cobbles separated them. A lifetime of trust had already collapsed between those windows. Palmer moved between his house and the inn with ease. He was, after all, Cook's friend, his physician, the man tending his illness out of kindness and concern. Servants grew accustomed to seeing the doctor across the street at all hours, carrying medicines, carrying food, carrying whatever Cook might need. They thought nothing of it. They thought it was kindness. Cook's condition fluctuated over those first days. He would improve slightly, enough to sit up, to take broth, to hope he might recover. Then he would worsen again, violently ill, racked with pain that seemed to come from nowhere. The pattern repeated. Improvement, collapse. Improvement, collapse. Each collapse followed by a visit from Palmer. On November the 17th, tragedy struck at the Palmer household. William's infant son, Alfred, died. Convulsions, the death certificate said. The fifth of Palmer's children to die the same way. 4 sons and a daughter, all dead before their first birthdays, all in convulsions. The neighbours offered condolences. A grieving father, they said. So much sorrow for one family. That same evening, the evening his infant son was laid out for burial, Palmer invited Cook to dine at his house. A grieving father seeking distraction, perhaps. Cook accepted. He was feeling better that day. He ate the food Palmer provided. He drank what Palmer poured. Within hours, Cook was violently ill again. The pattern was impossible to ignore, at least in hindsight.
November 19th, Palmer announced he would travel to London. Cook's racing affairs needed settling, he explained. The bookmakers held winnings from Shrewsbury. The betting books required attention. Someone needed to collect what Cook owed, and Cook was far too ill to travel himself. Cook must have been grateful. A friend handling tedious business while he recovered in bed. He handed over his betting books without hesitation. He gave Palmer authority to act on his behalf. Palmer boarded the morning train from Rugeley, 3 hours through the Midlands countryside to London. He arrived at Euston Station and moved through the city with purpose. His first stops were the bookmakers. Cook had won nearly £3,000 at Shrewsbury, but much of that money remained scattered across various betting accounts. Palmer collected what he could. He presented himself as Cook's agent. He pocketed the money. Then came the forgeries. Palmer had done this before, forging his mother's signature, his brother Walter's name. His hand was steady. He drafted checks in Cook's name, totaling hundreds of pounds. Cook's signature perfectly imitated. Cook's money flowing into Palmer's accounts. The debts demanded payment. The money lenders were growing impatient. Palmer needed every pound he could steal. Evening fell over London. The glass lamps flickered to life along the streets. Palmer made one final stop before catching his train home. Hawkins' chemist shop. Charles Newton worked behind the counter that night. Newton was a medical student, young, attentive, trained to follow proper procedure. He recorded every transaction in the poison register. Even a physician needed documentation. Even a surgeon needed a reason. Palmer requested 3 grains of strychnine. He asked for it casually, the way a doctor might request any common pharmaceutical. Newton asked the purpose. Standard procedure. For destroying stray dogs near his stable, Palmer explained. A common enough use for strychnine in rural areas. Farmers and horse owners used it regularly to control vermin. Newton asked for the name of a horse. This too was standard practice, a way of verifying the purchaser's identity, of ensuring the poison went where it was supposed to go. Palmer named a horse called Doctor. He did not own a horse by that name. 3 grains of strychnine. Newton weighed it carefully on the brass scales. 3 grains, approximately 3 lethal doses for a human being. He recorded the sale in the poison register, noting the date, the quantity, the purchaser's name. Palmer paid and left. The last train to Rugeley departed at 9 o'clock. Palmer boarded with Cook's money in one pocket and strychnine in the other. He arrived home near midnight. The light still burned in room 10 of the Talbot Arms. Cook was still alive, still trusting, still waiting for his friend, the doctor, to return.
The day before Palmer's London trip, something had happened that would prove crucial at trial. Elizabeth Mills, the chambermaid attending Cook at the Talbot Arms, tasted his coffee on November the 18th. Perhaps she was checking the temperature before serving it. Perhaps she was simply curious about the broth that Palmer brought so faithfully to the sick room. Whatever her reason, she drank from Cook's cup. What happened next was striking. Within hours, Mills fell violently ill. The same symptoms as Cook. Stomach pains that doubled her over. Nausea that wouldn't stop. Weakness that kept her in bed. Mills recovered within days. Cook did not. The difference, prosecutors would later argue, was simple. Mills tasted once, from a single cup. Cook received dose after dose, day after day, from the hands of his trusted physician. November the 20th, Dr. William Bamford was summoned to room 10. Bamford was 82 years old, respected Rugeley physician who had practiced medicine for half a century. His hands shook with age, but his reputation was impeccable. Bamford examined Cook and diagnosed severe gastric disturbance. He prescribed morphine pills to ease the stomach pain, standard treatment for the era. The pills would be prepared by the local chemist and delivered to the Talbot Arms. Palmer intercepted the prescription. He drew Bamford aside, one physician speaking to another. "Let me prepare something special," he suggested. "Something more suited to Cook's particular condition. I know his constitution. I know what he needs." Bamford agreed, one physician deferring to another. Professional courtesy between colleagues. Palmer disappeared into his private room. The surgery attached to his house, where he kept his instruments, his medicines, his secrets. The prosecution would later ask the jury to imagine what happened in that room. The morphine pills sitting on his workbench. The 3 grains of strychnine purchased the night before in London. The careful hands of a surgeon who knew exactly how much poison would kill a man. Palmer emerged with pills of his own preparation. He carried them across the street to room 10. He administered them to Cook personally, watching as his friend swallowed the medicine, watching as Cook thanked him for his care. Cook took the pills around 11 o'clock that night. Within an hour, his condition deteriorated sharply.
November 20th became November 21st. The clock in the Talbot Arms struck midnight. Most of Rugeley slept, unaware of what was happening in room 10. Cook did not sleep. He couldn't. His stomach burned. His muscles twitched involuntarily. Small spasms at first, barely noticeable, but growing stronger. Something was terribly wrong. Something beyond ordinary illness. He called for help. His voice was weak, but the night porter heard him. The porter fetched Elizabeth Mills, the same chambermaid who had tasted Cook's coffee and fallen ill herself. Mills found Cook doubled over in his bed, clutching his abdomen with both hands. His face was pale as candle wax. His breathing came in short, sharp gasps. Sweat soaked through his nightshirt. They sent for Dr. Palmer. Palmer arrived within minutes. He must have been awake, watching that window across the street. He must have been waiting for this moment. He walked into room 10 with the calm authority of a physician answering a medical emergency. Strychnine attacks the nervous system with terrible efficiency. The poison blocks the receptors that normally inhibit muscle contraction. The chemical signals that tell your muscles when to relax. Without that break, every muscle fires at once. The body seizes. The spine arcs backward in a terrible curve that medical texts call opisthotonus. The body bent like a bow drawn to breaking. The victim remains conscious throughout. Strychnine does not cloud the mind. It leaves its victims aware of every convulsion, every spasm, every moment of their own death. Shortly after midnight, Cook's convulsions began. Elizabeth Mills watched from the doorway of room 10. She saw Cook's body arc backward, off the mattress with such force but only his heels and the back of his head touched the bed. His fists clenched so tightly that his nails cut into his palms. His jaw locked shut, every muscle in his body rigid as iron. He screamed one word through his clenched teeth. Murder. Palmer stood at the bedside. Mills would later testify, under oath, in the most famous courtroom in England, that he made no move to restrain Cook, no attempt to ease the convulsions, no emergency measures of any kind. The physician simply watched. The convulsions lasted perhaps 10 minutes. Then Cook's heart stopped. The muscles that had been seizing finally relaxed. The room fell silent. John Parsons Cook is dead. He was 28 years old.
Dawn came grey and cold over Rewsley. Word spread quickly through the market town. John Parsons Cook was dead. The racing gentleman who had won so handsomely at Shrewsbury. Dead in his room at the Talbot Arms. Palmer took immediate control of the situation. He ordered a coffin from the local carpenter before Cook's body was cold. He began making funeral arrangements, the grieving friend handling difficult details so that others wouldn't have to. He also signed the death certificate himself. Cause of death, apoplexy, a stroke, natural causes. A man in his 20s, no history of heart trouble, dead of a stroke in the middle of the night. Palmer moved through Cook's belongings that morning. He searched the room methodically. He intercepted mail before it could reach Cook's family. Letters Cook had written in his final days, addressed to his stepfather, to friends, to anyone who might listen. Did those letters contain accusations? Warnings? We'll never know. Those letters disappeared. The £3,000 Cook had won at Shrewsbury. Most of it remained deposited with Ishmael Fisher, a racing acquaintance Cook had trusted with his winnings. But the rest had vanished. The money Palmer had collected in London, the forged cheques, all of this absorbed into Palmer's debts. Elizabeth Mills told the other servants what she witnessed in room 10. The screams, the convulsions, the doctor who simply stood and watched. Whispers spread through the Talbot Arms, through the market square, through every street in Rugeley. William Stephen, Cook's stepfather, was already travelling north from London when word reached him. He had received a letter about his stepson's illness. Now he received words of his stepson's death. Stevens arrived in Rugeley on November the 23rd. He found Cook already in a coffin, the betting books missing, the Shrewsbury winnings unaccounted for, and a death certificate signed by the last man to see Cook alive. A death certificate that claimed natural causes for a 28-year-old who had died screaming. Stevens began asking questions. Difficult questions. Questions that William Palmer couldn't answer.
John Parsons Cook trusted William Palmer. He trusted him as a friend, a fellow racing enthusiast, a drinking companion at tracks across England. When Cook won at Shrewsbury, Palmer was the first to raise a glass in celebration. He trusted him as a physician. When Cook fell ill, when that first dose of poisoned brandy began its work, Palmer was there, crossing the street at all hours, bringing medicine, bringing comfort, bringing death in careful doses. Victorian medicine operated on faith. Patients trusted doctors implicitly, completely, without question. Physicians held unquestionable authority over treatment, diagnosis, and the final determination of how a person had died. Palmer exploited every element of that trust. His friendship opened doors. His credentials silenced questions. His proximity ensured no one else could intervene. 6 days, from Shrewsbury to room 10, from celebration to convulsion. Palmer had planned it carefully. the trip to London to collect Cook's money. The strychnine purchased at Hawkins' chemist's shop. The intercepted pills. Each step deliberate. Each movement calculated. Cook died screaming murder. His friend, the doctor, stood beside the bed and simply watched. But Palmer had made mistakes. He had assumed no one would question a physician's diagnosis. He had assumed grief with silenced doubt. He had assumed that a death certificate, signed by a doctor, would close every door. He couldn't know that William Stevens was already demanding answers. He couldn't know that Stevens would refuse to accept apoplexy as explanation. Couldn't know that the coming weeks would bring an inquest, an exhumation, and a forensic examination that would put Victorian toxicology itself on trial. Palmer stood beside Cook's deathbed and simply watched. The chambermaid saw him. The servants whispered. And yet he signed that death certificate without a moment's hesitation. How many other death certificates did Victorian physicians sign without question? How many other murders slipped past simply because a doctor's word was law? Next episode, the stepfather demands an autopsy. The body tells its secrets. And William Palmer discovers that the same medical knowledge that made him a killer now makes him a suspect. Until next time, good night, friend.